Hello and welcome to Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. In order to set the tone for this week's programme, I'd like you to listen to some music played by Bob Wander. And that is a piece of music from the 18th century, and on this week's programme, we're going to back in time to the 1700s. Our mission is to learn about the beginnings of children's literature. How did it come about? What was it like? What does it tell us about children and about schooling at the time? Our guide for this tour is Dr. Matthew Grenby, a reader in children's literature at Newcastle University and an expert on children's literature of the 18th century. He was the keynote speaker at the 9th annual conference of the Irish Society for the Study of Children's Literature. I met up with him and began our conversation by asking him what it was like to be a child in the 1700s.
In terms of children, what people would say is that the concept of childhood was actually quite new then. Some historians think that's the case. Some people doubt it. But there is still this idea, which is difficult to shake off, that childhood hadn't really been invented for terribly long. Children had previously been regarded as little adults, and they were only just coming into their own right as a kind of separate group of people who needed their own products, like books, for instance. So that's why children's literature, I think, kicks off in the middle of the 18th century, because, well, partly for economic reasons, partly to do with the publishing trade, but certainly to do with this idea that people are for the first time realising that childhood is something different and needs to be treated differently.
What was the impetus then from childhood being kind of considered a separate entity at that time?
Well, yeah, interesting. I think it partly is to do with demographics, that's to say, the fact that children are going to survive much more, they're much more likely to survive, means that their parents and other parts of members of society are willing to invest in them emotionally, but also invest in them financially. So that's because childhood mortality rates are going down. There are also big economic arguments as well. Britain, Ireland, becoming richer. And so it's an old cliche of history, but there's a growing middle class. And that middle class is able to invest more in childhood as well. They see that as a kind of way of sustaining their own prestige and building their family's prestige for future generations as well. So everything's really coming to a head. Demographics, economics, social and cultural factors, all these things are coming to a head to enable, you know, to kind of make childhood more of a central concern in society.
And one of the most notable publications for adults and for educators in that century was Rousseau's Emile. Was Rousseau responding to childhood, or was he influential in having it defined at that time?
So Rousseau comes along in the 1760s, and before him we've got John Locke as well. These are the two people, John Locke's earlier in the 1690s, but also a very important theoretician of education. These are two people that people would normally talk about as having a profound effect on the way that education and childhood is understood. I think what you suggested in your question is more of the truth, though, that they're responding to as much as creating this new ethos of education. So, for instance, if we look at Locke, then a lot of what he says in Some Thoughts Concerning Education, 1693, has actually already been available in books which were published a couple of years before that, you know, 5 or 10 years before that. And you could say the same kind of thing about Rousseau, that a lot of his ideas are actually kind of milling around in the Enlightenment ethos of the middle of the 18th century. So I wouldn't say which is the chicken and which is the egg, but they're coming along together, these changes.
And what kind of genres then of children's literature do we see at this time? Because the novel itself was just emerging as a form at that time.
So a lot of the old genres continue. So fables, for instance, have always been given to children, and they continue to be given to children. So too do books of instruction, religious books, all that sort of thing. But from the middle of the 18th century, we're getting a new form developing in parallel to that, which are, as you're suggesting, little fictions. People tend to call them moral tales. These are novels compressed into a very small compass designed specifically for children. And alongside the moral tales, you've also got little kind of fun books, books of poems, books of activities, books of jests, books of games. All of these sort of things are often combined together. But it's that's one important trend. But I wouldn't want to give you the impression that's the only kind of book which is being made available, because there are still lots of instructive books, and the market is probably dominated by these instructive books. And they are also changing, because they are, people, educators, are thinking of the ways that they can make those instructive books much more suitable for children. They can change the diction, they can, you know, they can change the vocabulary, they can change the subject matter, they can also change the way they look, the way they're presented, and the way they're marketed. So it's across all of those different kinds of approaches that the changes are happening. There are new forms and there are old forms, but they both come under this new heading of the new children's literature.
And when you then think of the major high points of children's literature during the 18th century, what were they?
Well, the real pioneer and the person who I'm most interested in is a guy called John Newbery. And we know about him because of the Newbery Medal, of course, is given in America for the best children's books of the year. But Newbery is a real pioneer. No one really knows who wrote the books that he published. Maybe he did himself, but he's also got a lot of celebrated friends in London, like Oliver Goldsmith and Christopher Smart, people who are quite established as writers themselves, but seem to turn their hands to children's books. He publishes, he's often considered to publish the first of these, this new generation of children's books, which is called A Little Pretty Pocket Book, which is in 1744. That's interesting, but it's not so interesting as some of the ones that come after that. The Lilliputian Magazine. That's probably the first magazine, the first serial publication ever designed for children. That's 1751 to 1752. So that's really early on. And then perhaps his most famous, at least because it's entered our language, is A History of Little Goody Two-Shoes, 1765. Another really fascinating book. But there are a whole bunch of them in the 1740s, 50s and 60s that he and other people are publishing. And by the time we get to the 70s and 80s, this new children's literature has really taken off.
And the books that you talked about that were published, say, by Newbery, would they have contained fairy tales, or what would the content of those stories have been?
Fairy tales is a big grey area, not so much a grey area, but an area of huge debate. Partly, this new generation of children's books is written in opposition to fairy tales. Fairy tales, under the, you know, Locke's idea, is that if you give fairy tales to children, this is going to turn them into frightened, you know, victims of their own superstitions, who are going to be able to have to hide behind trees because they're so afraid of ghosts and the dark and so on. So there's this kind of great hostility to fairy tales. On the other hand, some fairy tales do get into children's books because they can become moralised very quickly. And people realise, they're thinking about this all the time, they realise that fairy tales are something that children like, but they're worried about Locke, so they change the fairy tales and they make sure that they explain all the supernatural elements, and they bring in a kind of moral didacticism to sit alongside the supernatural elements. So there are fairy tales. Others are little compressed novels. Newbery's a real kind of pioneer. He's not quite clear what he's doing, so he has a scattergun approach. He will have all sorts of genres in the Lilliputian magazine, for instance. He's got little poems, he's got little songs, he's got little jest, but he's also got these compressed novels, and he's also got little utopian fictions as well. Things a little bit like Swift's Gulliver's Travels get in there, but in much, much, much condensed form.
And what kind of quality was the paper that these books were printed on, and were they illustrated?
Yeah, so this is one of the big steps forward, I think, the way that the books are much more attractive to look at. So there are these illustrations. Newbery has quite what we consider to be quite crude illustrations, but because they're crude, he can include a lot of them. And so the books are very lovely to look at. He also pioneers decorative covers, covers which come in sort of reds and greens and golds. And he makes the book small as well. The thinking, perhaps now in the 21st century, is that very small children need very big books. But then in the middle of the 18th century, their thinking was that small children need small books because they're small people. So you can really, you know, these Newbery books, you can tell them a long way off when you see maybe someone using them in a library or something like that, because they're tiny, but they're very beautiful, like little jewels.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Grenby from Newcastle University. We're talking about children's literature of the 18th century. My next question was to ask Matthew Grenby which children were reading the children's books that were available at the time.
Well, this is some research I've been doing recently, and it's a fascinating question, who was reading these books? No one has really looked at that, but you can find out. And the way I've been able to find out is by looking at the inscriptions that children left in their books. So children prize these books, they love them, and so very often they wrote their names in them. And if they write their names and the dates, and often the place where they live as well, you can find out who they are. You can go back to the parish records or later on the census records and find out who they are. Now, the really interesting thing, I think, is that the huge majority of the market are girls rather than boys. Now, there are all sorts of reasons why that might be the case. Maybe the boys took their books to school and they got destroyed there or something like that. Maybe only the girls' books were looked after and so ended up in the libraries today, which means I could find the inscriptions in them. I don't know. But there's such an overwhelming majority of girls' inscriptions that there is a case for saying that what we call children's literature should really be called girls' literature, because they were the primary consumers. Perhaps the boys had a more traditional curriculum. They were looking at kind of the Latin books, the Greek books, maths books, what have you, when they went to school. So that's the gender issue. In terms of class, I found a huge difference of people who were owning these books. Some were very affluent, so you get people right at the top of society, aristocracy, even monarchy, owning these books. But you also get people whose parents, when you go back to the parish records, appear to be very humble indeed. Innkeepers, artisans, shopkeepers. So actually, whereas we might assume it's a middle and upper class phenomenon, that's not necessarily the case. And, you know, some diaries, for instance, some letters will reveal that really quite poor people, just determined to try and invest in their children as much as they could by spending their hard-won and very small amounts of capital on their children's education. In terms of age, you know, we're talking about 4 to 7 year olds. That's the classic age. No, perhaps a little bit older than 7, 8, 9, perhaps as well. And by the time that many children have gone on to sort of their early, you know, 12 or 13, they're often reading adult works or adult novels, or at least they're being criticised for doing so. You know, there was a kind of graduation point at about the age of 12 or 13, I think. In terms of location, what I was surprised to find was that, judging by the inscriptions, it's not purely an urban phenomenon. I had imagined that it would be the kind of, you know, the urban elites who are reading and buying this new product. But actually, they're spread around the country. When I say the country, I mean England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. And books published in London find their way all over the British Isles into the tiny villages. You know, there's quite a good distribution network by this time, so they're really spread around the country. And in fact, they go abroad. You know, publishers this time, they're very anxious to get arrangements going with agents in India or Russia or the American colonies as well. So these books published in London, Dublin, Edinburgh, wherever they may be, they have quite a large reach.
You've mentioned Dublin there in Ireland. One of the authors that I know who wrote for children in the 18th century was Maria Edgeworth. How would you assess her contribution to the genre?
Oh, yeah, she's an important figure. Open any history of children's books and she'll be there, and rightfully so. Partly because she's influential. She's a kind of well known that she's a follower of Rousseau. Her family, her father, is particularly a follower of Rousseau, and so she's often seen as someone who takes Rousseau and puts it into children's books. She's also a fantastic writer as well, and I'm not saying that all of the children's literature from this period is good, but hers definitely is. You know, she has a real way of writing for children, and her books definitely stand the test of time. But she's interesting for all sorts of reasons as well. She's interesting because she's obviously very thoughtful about what it is that a girl as opposed to a boy should be reading, and or a boy as opposed to a girl. And she's also often seen as a kind of purveyor of a particular value system, which is about thinking for yourself and about achieving for yourself on the basis of your own merits. So she's a great representative of this kind of bourgeois enlightenment, as people would call it, this sense that you can make what you want of yourself through your own hard work and your own education.
Are any of the authors from the 1700s still read by children today?
So I set up a website a few years ago. It's called the Hockliffe website. And on that we had digital images of a lot of 18th century children's books. And occasionally I would get emails or phone calls from people telling me that they love them. They were using them with their children now in the 21st century. And I just felt so sorry for those children, because these books are interesting, I think, to the cultural historian. They are not all of them fantastic books to read now, I have to say, and some do stand the test of time, but those, you know, and would be suitable for children now, but those tend to be the ones which are poems, nursery rhymes, the short stories. Otherwise, you know, a lot of this material really is very didactic, and I wouldn't recommend it to my own children. And I should say as well that what I found was investigating children's attitudes, 18th century children's attitudes to these books, is not necessarily that they're enjoying them either, or at least not that they're enjoying them in the approved ways. The reason why they enjoy them is often as much physical and material as it is textual. You know, they might talk about how they like the story, yes, but what they really liked was owning the books. In this period, as a child, you couldn't own very much at all. You know, this wasn't a consumer culture which favoured the child. Maybe you'd have your own clothes, but toys would be few. So when they got to own books, this was, you know, one of the few things that they could own. Secondly, they had a very physical relationship with their books, which surprised me. Well, maybe it didn't surprise me, but it was interesting to see it pointed out. You know, they loved to kind of turn the pages. They loved to colour the book. They loved to write things in the book. It's a very interactive relationship that they had. And they're always being told off for that. Their parents, their teachers, the books themselves are reprimanding them for this kind of physical understanding of their book. Don't throw it around, don't colour in it, don't write in it, they say. Learn from the stories. But the children subvert that very quickly, and their chief gratification is to possess it, to write in it, to make it theirs. And so, from that point of view, I guess, you know, there's nothing to stop 21st century children having exactly the same kind of relationship with any book. They haven't perhaps changed that much from their 18th century forebears.
But presumably their 18th century forebears must have reread a lot, because they wouldn't have had television, they wouldn't have had computer games, and they wouldn't have had the same quantity of books as children today have.
Yes. I mean, historians of reading would talk about the way that in this early period, habits of reading are intensive rather than extensive. Intensive, they read over and over again. We do, from diaries and letters and so on, we do get accounts of that having happened. People who know a text very, very well indeed, and, you know, they love it. That's not so different in many ways from children today, but that's right. But on the other hand, let's not get carried away with that. We also know from diaries that children would, they like particular elements of a book, but not others. So, for instance, there was, this is going into the early 19th century book, but there was a book called The Fairchild Family by Mary Martha Sherwood. This is a very pious evangelical book, which is supposedly very popular, sells in huge numbers. But looking at children's diaries, they like some elements of it, but they admit to skipping huge bits of it. You know, the didactic material, the prayers that you get at the end of each chapter, even the most kind of very proper writers who are remembering using this book would happily confess to only liking certain elements of it and not others. We shouldn't have the impression that 18th century readers are very kind of doing exactly what they're told to do. They're just as subversive as any readers today.
If we move on to education, what can we learn about 18th century education or schooling or teaching from studying the children's literature of that time?
There are school stories. This is actually one of the first genres to get off the ground, the school story. People would often say the first school story, the first proper school story in the modern tradition is 1749. It's Sarah Fielding's The Governess. I suppose you could look at these school stories and think, well, this is what school was like in the 18th century. Maybe you could. Mariah Edgeworth writes a story called The Barring Out, which is about a custom in 18th century schools to bar out the teacher from your classroom. You know, you kind of bar yourself in with food and drink to try and you kind of create a siege as a protest against the way that the teacher is teaching you or failing to teach you. okay, that did happen, and we could look at these school stories as an indication of what school was like, but I'm not sure they give it a totally accurate representation. You know, the literature of the time is trying to present a particular rhetoric of education and trying to set it in a particular light, so it's often more polemical than it is representative. Another kind of problem I would envisage is that, remember, not everybody is going to school in the 18th century. Of course, the poor are not necessarily going to school. But even within those groups who are going to school, the middle classes, the upper classes, there's a big debate going on about whether private education is better than public education. Public education meaning schooling. Private education goes on in the home with a governess, with teachers. And it wasn't just the case that was for girls, whereas the public schooling was for boys. Often, you know, many families preferred a private education, even for boys. So I think what children's literature could give us more of an insight into is that private education, that domestic education, because these were the books which were designed to be used in that private setting. So we can get a sense of what was going on within the home, within educational patterns. And one thing that comes across quite strongly is the importance of conversation. So this was the big watchword of 18th century education, I think, that you should not simply read something, but the classically important thing was to talk about it with someone who was able to inform you and answer your questions, your parent or a teacher. And these books often stress, the prefaces, the introductions to these books, often stress that the book should not be used in isolation. It has to be used as part of a larger programme of conversation. The book is just a platform. There was a real anxiety, I think, in this period that this new product, children's literature, could be seen as being a substitute for the parent. But that was to be avoided at all cases, in all costs. It had to be a supplement to the parent. And so that's, I think, an interesting insight into what this domestic education was like.
But if we take that a step further, then, that sounds as if the books weren't particularly to be used for amusement or for enjoyment, as we would think of the reason that a lot of children would read today.
Yeah. The famous motto that John Newbery has is instruction and delight. So he sees them as going together, but they're always in service of each other. So you are supposed to enjoy it, but only because it will lead to a kind of instruction, usually a moral instruction. So no one's thinking that a child should not enjoy their books, but they're not thinking that it should be a pleasure on its own.
So if there is a moral undertone, and the word you've used quite a bit during the interview is didactic nature to these books, what were the values that children's literature was trying to inculcate in children?
Well, broadly speaking, these are the Christian virtues, and indeed including a strong piety very often. But most commentators would also say that they are the classic middle-class bourgeois virtues, that's to say industry, thrift, honesty. You know, the idea is that it's very easy to see that these books are designed to make a successful merchant, a successful trader. Having said that, as we get towards the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, these books, I think, have a more political edge to them as well. So they're trying to teach political values, which is how to be a good citizen, how to question as well the kind of state in which you live, how to relate to your fellow man through a process of empathy or sympathy. That's something that comes across strongly at the beginning of the 19th century when William Godwin, for instance, who's a famous philosopher and novelist and also an educationist, when he starts to publish his children's books, he's perhaps more obviously than many other people, he's thinking of children's literature as something which can teach values to improve society as a whole and not only to allow the individual to get on in life.
Another way that literature is sometimes used, or children's literature is sometimes used in schools today, is to develop literacy. Do you have any evidence saying that children's literature at this time was used to develop literacy skills as opposed to develop these moral and political or pedagogical ideas?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. the very first book that Newbery publishes for children, this A Little Pretty Pocket Book, you know, if you open that, it's got an ABC in the first page, and then it will take you through A is 4, B is 4, all the way through. So that's definitely a book which is designed to help children learn their alphabet, then to go on to learn syllables, then to go on to form words, then to go on to be able to read sentences and so on, which was very much the 18th century way. So that's an integral part of Newbery's idea. This is a book he thinks which you should use right from the time when you're beginning to learn to read. It's the same with Goody Two Shoes as well. Goody Two Shoes is a novel. It's a kind of short novel about this girl who goes out and makes her way in the world. It's a sort of Cinderella story. She succeeds in the world and marries the local squire by virtue of her by her hard work and her education. But what it's also is a book which is designed to teach children their alphabet as well, because her first, the way she drags herself out of penury is because she herself establishes a kind of school in which she takes round the letters on wooden blocks, A, B, C and so on, and she takes them around and shows them to other children and teaches them to read. Now, what Newbery's so clever at doing is he includes in his own texts the letters. He says, she set down the letters before her, A, B, C, D, and so on. And so the child who's using this book will read as the pupils in her school read. And then Little Goody Two Shoes muddles up the letters. And those are printed in the book as well, allowing the person who's reading that to kind of pick out the letters and put them in the order. So it's quite clever what Newbery's doing. But what's interesting is that for John Newbery, right in the middle of the century, a single book should serve readers from the very beginning of their literary skills all the way up to, you know, when they can read a novel. They're just going to read that book in different ways across that whole period. But quite quickly, by the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, that idea has gone, and you've got this sense of an expanding market where there are different books for very young readers who are just learning and different books for much more proficient readers who are well on the way to full literacy.
And that was Dr. Matthew Grenby from Newcastle University, who was the keynote speaker at the 9th Annual Conference of the Irish Society for the Study of Children's Literature. Well, that's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest on the programme this week, Matthew Grenby. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.